As we close out this section here, Jesus defines for us unbelief and belief. But as we close it out, he speaks of unbelief. Unbelief is not a polite unwillingness to assent to some fact, but is a flat refusal. It's a flat refusal to listen to his truth and to acknowledge his claims on one's personal life. All right, that's the problem people have. They don't want to acknowledge God's claim on their personal life. This is my life. I'm going to live it the way I see it. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm nobody's servant, not even the Lord's. I'll go so far. I'll give a dollar. I'll go to church on Sunday, but that's it. There's a limit. I think you get the gist of how Jesus explained here in this verse 48, his definition of unbelief. Unbelief is not a polite unwillingness to accept some fact. That's not the case at all. It is a flat refusal to listen to his truth and to acknowledge his claims as one's personal on one's personal life. Because Jesus said, "He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my sayings," that's verse 48. That's Jesus' definition of unbelief. Unbelief faces certain judgment by the everlasting truth which Christ proclaimed as it was given him by the Father. And we've already went through this, you know, in another study. But he said, beginning in verse 48, "He that rejects me and receives not my sayings hath one that judgeth him. The words that I spake, the same shall judge him in the last day." Are we aware of what judgment we're going to stand before? His words, what he spoke. Did he speak something about baptism? Listen to it again, Luke 16. Well, I forgot where it's at.
In the Bible.
Mark 16:15-16.
"He that believeth," believeth what? My words. "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." Does that qualify salvation? Does it limit salvation? Yes, it does. It limits it to a baptism, a belief that's a baptism that's based on belief. And there's where salvation is acquired. That's where it's not a thing that you earn. You don't earn anything. But as Paul said, and I love this idea, it's one that's not advocated much. But Paul said, "Love constrains me." And so we're not obedient because we just forcing ourselves to, or putting a gun to our head and making ourselves do it. Love is the motive. Love is the motivator. Love is the thing that brings you into compliance with what God wants and what Jesus said. And so the judgment will not be a matter of caprice or of favoritism at all, but of eternal justice, the word of the Lord. And so, I'm sure we all know what the word caprice means. It means a sudden impulse, change in the way that a thing or place is done. That won't be the kind of judgment we'll face. We'll face the words of our Lord that we have right here. Everybody's got one, don't they? And I mean, the Goodwill's got them. They're handing them out for free. The world's full of them. It's the most popular book in the world. There's more Bibles sold every year than any other book in the world. And yet they're the least read, I would assume, of any book in the world. And everybody wants one on their cabinet or on their, you know, their coffee table. Don't it look impressive? I got the Word of God. I don't have a clue what it says. Don't really care, but I have it. I'm too busy with other things. I'm too busy with the temporal things that goes to the grave. I ain't got time for eternal things. I think you see the asinine picture of our attitudes on the main scale. I'm not talking about your attitude necessarily. I don't know what it is altogether. But I'm talking about mankind as a whole. That's the way he views things. And so God's message in Christ is thus the hope of the believer and the condemnation of the unbeliever. So whether you believe or whether you don't, you're going to stand before this word. You're going to fall because of this word. Because he said in verse 50, his commandment is life eternal. And the word shall judge him in the last day, verse 48. Pretty clear, isn't it? Anybody have a problem understanding that? Now we're going to go into the Last Supper that's presented in chapter 13, verse 1 through 20. And we're going to see an example that Jesus set for you and me. And we're going to find ourselves falling way short of his example. Now, I'm not trying to indict anybody. I just want you to be acutely aware that we have a serious problem in no compliance to the love of God that was shed, that was shown here in this Last Supper. That'll be our task this morning. And there's six expressions of that divine love on the board. And I'm sure that we're not going to sink our axe very deep into the tree of love, the understanding of it, but we're going to attempt it as we see what Jesus done here in the supper. Let's read this context. Chapter 13, verse 1 through 20. We're reading it because probably a lot of people have no idea what it says. They either didn't know that that's what we're studying this morning, or they come unprepared. Now, before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. And supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things unto his hand, and that he was come from God and went to God, he raiseth from supper and laid aside his garments and took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter said unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said unto him, What I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. And Peter said unto him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. And Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Incidentally, can you see in that Jesus' reference to the cross and the washing of sin from the blood of Christ, by the blood of Christ? This all had symbolic meaning. It was a parable in symbolic meaning. He said, if I don't wash you, you have no cleansing. You have no part with me. And he was looking beyond the foot washing. The foot washing was a picture of his submission to the cross for mankind as he steeped it, as he went as low as he could go to save man. He humbled himself to man's feet, as it were. That's the parable. And he told Peter, if I can't wash your feet, then you have no part with me. And he was referring in his mindset to that day when he'd offer himself for the sins of the world and the cleansing aspect of the blood. Now, I hope we see that. I hope we see that. Verse 9, Simon Peter said unto him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Now, Peter didn't understand what he said, but he did understand that he wanted to part with the Lord regardless of what it cost. He wanted the blessings of the Lord regardless of what it cost. He'll learn later what it costs. Jesus said unto him, he that is washed needeth not save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit. And ye are clean, but not all. For he knew who should betray him. Therefore he said, ye are not all clean. So after he'd washed their feet and had taken his garments and was set down again, he said unto them, know ye what I have done unto you? Now, I hope we're intelligent enough to see that Jesus is not teaching foot washing. Yet there's many denominations that's out here practicing foot washing. They think that washing somebody's dirty feet is going to get them into heaven. And that's not the implication here at all. Has nothing to do with foot washing, although it is foot washing. It has much deeper meaning, as we'll see on the board here, as it illustrates and makes known the divine nature of God's love. He said in verse 13, ye call me Master and Lord, and ye say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example. Now this is an example. And that's why the denomination world practices it. They don't see the lesson in it. All they see is foot washing. Isn't that pathetic? For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. And he's talking about serving others. He's not talking about foot washing. Because he's already told Peter, you don't know what I'm doing right now. Well, Peter wasn't an idiot. He could see Jesus was washing their feet, and he refused to have Jesus do that. A great master like Jesus washing my feet? Oh, no, no, no. It's hard to accept the free gift of God on the cross, the washing away of sin by the blood of Christ. But Jesus, as he's washing feet, and they all know what he's doing at that moment, he said, you don't know what I'm doing now, but you will one day. Well, I can see Peter, you know, like a lot of us. Well, what do you mean, Lord? I can see you're washing feet. No, he's not washing feet. He's teaching humility. He's teaching humility by the master of heaven and earth, the one who now knows that he came from God and is going to God. And he bent and washed feet. And he said, this is an example for you. Is Christ our example? Are we to serve one another? I think so. Are we to love one another regardless of our problems? I think so. Are we to love the lost? No, I condemn them. They need to go to the gallows. Oh, really? Well, then you don't understand Christianity at all. You're judgmental. You're self-righteous. Should I go on? Because those are the elements of a person who stands in judgment of anybody else. As Paul said, thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift. Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he might be his instructor, his counselor, or who has first given to him that he should recompense unto him again? For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. Romans 13. No. I forget. It's in Romans. Where did I finish reading there? Verse 16. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, and neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. I speak not of you all. I know whom I have chosen. But that the scriptures may be fulfilled, he that eateth bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. Now I tell you before it come, that when it comes to pass, ye may believe that I am he. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that receiveth whomsoever I send receiveth me, and he that receiveth me receiveth him that sent me. Well, that's a concept there in John's Gospel of the Last Supper. Now there's some things that we need to note between John's Gospel and the Synoptics. Because why did John write what he wrote? He's not writing to give you a complete record. Luke done that. Remember Acts 1? Luke writes to Theophilus and he said that he had wrote in his former treatise, as he referred to those treatises being the Gospel of Luke. He said, I wrote in a former treatise of all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the time he was taken up. And so if you want a perfect picture of the life of Christ in everything that he done, go to Luke. Don't go to John. Because that's not John's purpose in writing. John has told you, and we've mentioned it many times, John 20, verse 30 and 31, when he finishes his epistle, he says, truly many other signs did Jesus in the presence of his disciples. It's not written in this book. But these that are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. And so John has a different purpose in writing than the other synoptic gospels. So John's account of the last meal of Jesus with his disciples differs in many respects from that of the Synoptics, because no mention is made of the preparation by Peter and John going after the room where they're going to eat dinner. No mention is made in John, or the procedure during the meal, and of the discourse concerning the significance of the bread and the cup, nor of the contention for primacy that took place among the disciples at the supper. Remember, at the supper and the other synoptic gospels, it's not recorded here by John, but it is by the others. You remember how the sons of Zebedee, James and John's mother, went to Jesus and said, Lord, when you come into your kingdom, let my son sit on your left hand and your right hand. Boy, if you were there, you could probably heard the apostles' teeth grind in anger, because they're all striving for a high position of service. They're like preachers today in the Church of Christ, striving to be noticed and recognized as the greatest preachers, you know, of today and all of that. And Jesus taught them humility here, knowing he was the Son of God, knowing his elevated position of being the creator of this universe, he humbled himself to our feet. And he said, I've left you an example that you might do the same thing. And so if we don't learn humility, there's not no hope for us. We might as well get out of here and go home and get out in this world and just kick up our heels and enjoy what's left of your life. But Christianity is humility. It's rendering oneself a servant to all, to the lost, to the saved, to the unloved, to the loved. It doesn't matter. That is the nature of Christ and his love. All right, so as we compare the Gospels with the other synoptics, with John, he doesn't record the contention for privacy or primacy that took place among the disciples at the supper that I just mentioned. They're all wanting first place. When he comes in his kingdom, boy, they want to be right there. And they're jealous of one another. They're envious of one another. And here James and John in the other Gospels, it's recorded how they mother went to Jesus and asked if her sons might, when he comes into his kingdom, might be on his right and his left hand. All of these are listed by one or more of the synoptic writers. On the other hand, the synoptics do not relate the story of the foot washing. They're not in those, only in John. Nor do they repeat fully Jesus' discourse on the example of service. Both John and the synoptics include Jesus' disclosure of the treachery of Judas and his sudden departure from the group. It may never be proved to the satisfaction of all that John did or did not have in his hand a copy of one or more of the synoptic gospels, but it seems reasonably certain that he knew the general body of certain traditions that was recorded therein, and that he purposely added to it. And so again, you got to remember John's purpose in writing. There's quite a bit of difference in the Gospels. Well, not a whole lot of difference, but a difference in their audiences they wrote to. Matthew wrote to the Jew because as he relates the history of different holidays and customs of the Jews, he doesn't bother to explain because he knows his audience understands because they're Jews. But when you get to Mark, he stops and explains all of these holidays because he's writing to the Gentile mind that may not understand the Jewish customs and traditions. That's easy to see. And then Luke, he writes to Theophilus. We don't know who Theophilus is. All we know is he's called Most Excellent Theophilus. And Luke wrote to him about all that Jesus began both to do and to teach until the time he was taken up. And he also wrote to Theophilus the book of Acts. Read chapter 1, verse beginning in verse 1. He addressed it to Theophilus. We don't know who Theophilus was, but we know from a study of records that there was only certain ones in the highest office that was called and addressed in letters and documents as Most Excellent. And so whoever Theophilus was, he was a mighty man in the Roman government. And so that's who Luke wrote to. And then John wrote that as he presented merely the miracles that would show Jesus divine in every aspect of life, divine over nature, divine over diseases, divine over demons, divine over death, divine over quality, changing the water to wine. His divinity over quantity as he fed 38,000 people approximately with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And so in every way, John presents only those miracles that prove Jesus' divinity in the whole spectrum of life. Have you noticed on the bookshelves around in the history of your life, you're old enough to have seen this maybe, but you go to Bible bookstores, you go to Walmart, you go to any of those places, and they may not be now, but they used to be handouts, and they used to be books called the Gospel of John, and that was it. And you could buy it. Some denominations handed out the Gospel of John. You know why? Because of his purpose in writing. They didn't hand out the Gospel of Mark or Matthew or Luke. And I'm not belittling them. I'm just saying that they specified in handing out the Gospel of John because men have recognized what John said. I wrote these things that you might believe. And that believing you might have life in his name. All right, on the other hand, the narrative of chapter 13 here has some affirmities with the synoptic record, particularly with that of Luke. All accounts are dated in the hours just preceding the Passover. The common center of interest was the last meal with the disciples, and the fact that Jesus knew in advance the identity of the traitor. The epistle of foot washing is more easily understandable if it is coupled with the quarrel of the disciples over who should be the greatest that we discussed a while ago. You know, that's what destroys congregations, is someone wanting to be great. And they badmouth others. They speak against others rather than help them. And rather than looking upon the congregation and maybe helping the preacher, they badmouth. They speak against. They decide what they like and what they don't like. That's what destroys congregations. Is somebody wanting to be great. Somebody wanting to tell everybody how it ought to be. Rather than washing feet. The discourse on serving as given by Luke in Luke 22... verse 24 through 30, accords closely with Jesus' explanation of the foot washing as given in John 13, verse 12 through 20 that we're in. And the disclosure of the traitor was made through the dipping of the salt. The event of the Johannine and synoptic accounts can be harmonized satisfactorily. So there is no contradiction between them. It's just that they had different purposes in writing and different audiences. Keep that in mind as you're reading the scriptures. Because some idiot is surely going to come along and say, well, see there, John didn't record this, so he's not inspired. No, that ain't the problem at all. That ain't the situation at all. He had a different purpose in writing. I hope you get that. Because the devil is cunning and crafty and smooth like glass. He'll slide in on you and in your thinking with things and divide and destroy and dampen your faith if you let him. We're soldiers, though. We've been given a sword, haven't we? Can you whoop him with the sword? Is God's sword limited? The one he gives us in Ephesians 6, 10 through 18. Above all, out front of all, hold the sword. Which is the word of God. And by it, you can whoop any enemy. Problem is, most of us don't know enough about the sword. We got it. See my beautiful sword. Oh, I paid good money for this because it's got Morocco leather on it. You know. But what's in it? I don't know, but I got one. Well, what good's a soldier if he's got one? I get so tickled at people with guns. I got protection. Where's it at? It's locked up in a safe and it's empty because I don't want nobody getting hurt with it. Well, what good is it? What good is an unloaded, locked up pistol? Is the enemy going to say, well, I was going to shoot you, but I'll give you a chance to get your gun now and then we'll have a battle? No, the enemy is laying like a serpent watching you. If you're a young lady coming out of Walmart, the serpent is out there in the darkness watching you. And he's planning. He looks around and sees if a stage is set in that parking lot to where he can slip up behind you and force you in the car and do his will, whatever it is. And here's Lulu.
La, 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 la.
She don't look around. She don't know who's on her left or on the right. She don't know who's following her. She don't know. She just,
la, 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 la.
Because she's got this false confidence. We got police will take care of that. No, they're not there when it happens. They're not there. I had a confrontation with the FBI director over in Pasco one time. And I told him, you're nothing but a janitorial service. I said, you're there to clean the mess up after it happens. And I pack a gun because I don't intend to be your mess. And he laughed. He said, we've been called a lot of names, but that's the first time we've ever been called a janitorial service, because that's all they are. But people put trust in false things. And we've been given a sword. If you don't know how to use it, what good is it? If you don't know the strategy of battle, if you haven't practiced, what good is it? You go in the military and they're going to spend the first 6 months of your training in what's called boot training. And they're going to train you how to use weaponry. They're going to train you so that when you go into combat, it's going to be automatic. It's not going to be, let me get my manual and see what I'm supposed to do here with this thing. It's going to be automatic. But again, not condemning anybody, but just stating a general rule, we go through life like Lulu.
La, 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 la.
Just enjoying the dainties. Isn't that good? Oh, here's some more weird. Not seeing the dangers, not really caring. Just looking for,
I just want to be happy.
Well, one day you ain't going to be so happy because you'll be judged by his words. That's serious, isn't it? Now, you guys know, me being human, I have human ways.
No.
So every now and then, every now and then, I have to spew a little bit. Allow me that. I'm your brother. You gotta love me. I may not be very lovable, but you gotta love me. Of course, that works the other way too, and that's hard to take.
We rejoice in our trials.
Did I hear some sarcasm?
Well, Merle, that might be why Robin's giving you all them sweets.
I already told him that.
Yeah, maybe she tried to sweeten you up a little.
Well, I am elevated. Now, there is a very distinctive emphasis in the Jonanian story here. The key statement is Jesus, knowing that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own that were in the world, he loved them unto the end. Verse 1. The stress there is not on the new covenant, which is prominent in the synoptics, but on Jesus' personal love for his disciples. Now, what about his personal love? The meaning can be made clear by a paraphrase of verse 1. Jesus, because he loved his own that were in the world, made one final demonstration of that love. And you're going to wash your fingers. The significance is not that he loved them to the last of his life, but that he loved them to the uttermost degree of which he was capable as a human being. And washing their feet. Was Jesus limited in his love? Boy, Happy, that's a hard question, isn't it? Oh, he was divine! Yeah, but don't you remember Philippians 2:5? He humbled himself and emptied himself of his divine prerogatives. He was tempted in all points like as we are. You began to add them things up in understanding, and he was limited in his ability to love. Because he was a man. Remember, he gave up his position as creator. He gave up his grand throne, as it were, of importance as creator and sustainer and all of that, and washed feet. So he loved them to the uttermost degree of which he was capable. The historic scene that followed was a dramatic exposition of the greatness of Christ's love for his disciples. It was a preview of the meaning of the cross, in which the essential elements of the divine love for man were all represented. Now, I'm not going to put this on the board next week. We're not going to finish it this morning. It'd be good to get a picture or write it down or something, because next week we're going to finish this, and hopefully you have a record of it coming before you in our study. Number one, first of all, it was a love that could not be quenched by evil. Evil has no power over the love of God. If the love of God resides in you, evil is no threat to you. Did God leave us ill-equipped down here?
In Ephesians, and he gave us a stupid shield and a stupid sword. We don't fight with that thing nowadays. Why didn't he give me an AK-47?
You see how we think? We think very shallow. But what did that sword and that shield and the helmet and the girdle and all the things that we're equipped with in Ephesians 6:10 through 18, what does those things imply? The completeness of weaponry and what we need to survive. Why did God allow the devil to touch Job? You ever wondered that? Why did God, in his great love, allow Job to undergo such temptation? You know why? Because God knew that the devil couldn't in no way. Evil cannot stand against the truth. And Job had it. And Job just needed to bring his mind into compliance with his actions and deeds. He needed some time to meditate, didn't he? And he did, on an ash heap, as he scraped his sores from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. He got bitter. God gave us the ability to be bitter, didn't he? Is it a thing of God? Yeah, it is. How about temper? It is too. All of the qualities that we have, we're made in the image of God. But we're also instructed by God and through life's toil to limit those and to harness them. What does James say about the tongue? It can't be tamed. Just put a rein on it like you do a horse and pull it back. And so, love cannot be quenched by evil. The words there in verse 4, where Jesus said, "The devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him," they modify the verbs there in verse 4. "He riseth, he layeth aside, and he took, and he girded himself to wash their feet." Boy, we don't do that with our enemy. You let somebody cross us, if it's a dear brother that, you know, just in a weak moment or whatever, he says some bad things about us, boy, we're going to get even. We're going to make him pay. We're going to show him. The service by which Jesus expressed his care for his disciples was offered in spite of his full knowledge of the coming betrayal by Judas, there in verse 11. And of the denial by Peter, verse 38, refusing to be washed. Notwithstanding treachery and cowardice on the part of men and professed followers that the divine love was given spontaneously and freely to all of them. Secondly, on the board, it was a love that tendered by Jesus in the full consciousness of his own exalted powers. Notice what verse 3 says. Knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, he deliberately subjected himself to the needs of his disciples and sacrificed himself for them by submitting to an authority which was beneath him. He was far above them. And yet he become a servant of all. Oh, man, there's humility. Servant of all. Now, if it were you and I, and I'm not trying to be judgmental, I'm just presenting a picture here of how it can be. It may not be in your case. If it isn't, well, good deal. But if you and I was there, we would have had a fit. I'm the creator of the world. Why? I'm the one that upholds all things. I am the one that's above all. And you have the gall to mess with me? That is our attitude toward the lost and toward the brothers in the church. Rather than humbling ourselves beneath them, bringing ourselves off our lofty heights of who we think we are, and coming down to serve our brothers. I'm not serving them. They ain't worthy of it. Why? They got to show some worth before I'm going to do anything for them. Why, them lowly people. That's the way we look on the brethren sometimes. Butch?
We're under rowers.
Exactly. Exactly. We give our life as an under rower. He didn't live very long.
Dad, can I make a comment?
Yeah. Whose comment?
Me.
Okay, yeah.
Apostle Paul from Philippians, the second chapter, kind of helps us to see exactly what you're pointing out about our
second chapter, or the second verse.
Philippians 2, verse 5. Where the Apostle Paul said, let this mind be in you, which was also in Jesus Christ. Being in the form of God, he thought it not robbery to be equal with God. He made of himself no reputation, and he took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And he's asking us to have this mind in us. We be like him. And being found in the fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross.
Yeah, but we got our lives, and they're so precious to us. Why, we're not going to go out of our way for anybody. Why? That's asking too much. Asking too much. And look what Jesus left to condescend to a state of being to save mankind. Thank you for that. Thank you, Butch, for what you commented on. Those things help. So he deliberately subjected himself to the needs of his disciples and sacrificed himself for them by submitting to an authority which was beneath him. His words to Pilate, you remember? Thou wouldest have no power against me except it be given you from above, in chapter 19, verse 11. And his claim His calm superiority to the numerous accusations of his enemies showed that he was a voluntary, not an unwilling victim. He volunteered to be a victim to save man. He volunteered to take the slander, to take the insults, to take the abuse, to take the cross for mankind. And you and I, we're sure glad that he died for us, but to hell with everybody else, you know. Why, the very idea, them asking of my time to be a teacher, to be a preacher, to be a member, involved with the church. No. I'm curious what to do. They're always doing this, and they're always doing that.
Alive
I had a brother.
Christ. Alive under Christ.
Yeah, I had a brother that used to call me every Sunday. Boy, they sure screwed up this morning. The preacher said this, they done this, and this, that, and the other. I said, well, what did you do? Well, he didn't say this, but here was the intent. I ain't got time to do anything. I'm too busy commenting. I'm a commentator. The church is made up of the Tater family, dictators, commentators, agitators. And there's a few sweet taters.
Spectators.
And the Tater family. Our time's up. I'm not going to push it. We're going to begin with the third aspect, the third point that's illustrated here in the divine love of God in Jesus washing their feet. And today is what? 18?
Yeah.
I knew that. I just seen it. You guys knew it.
Yeah.
Dictator or commentator?